everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This week, my guest is Jordan Miller, who is the driving force behind the Satori Network. He's also the lead developer of Moontree, and we talk crypto and blockchain in this episode. And Jordan does a much, much better job of describing exactly what the Satori Network is in this episode. So I'm going to leave it to him a little bit later in the episode to kind of fill in all the details. The other thing that was really exciting in this interview was that Jordan taught me a new word, instantiate. And you all know that I love words I've never heard of before. So when Jordan used it, I thought, oh my gosh, what is that? And I had to run right after interviewing him and see what the definition was. And instantiate means to provide an instance of or concrete evidence in support of, like a theory, a concept, or a claim. There is an Easter egg at the end of this episode, so after the credits, if you still want to hear a little bit more of my interview with Jordan, stick around and you can listen to that. And then I loved the name of Jordan's Satori Network, and I found a gorgeous, gorgeous quotation about Satori, which we talk about a little bit later in the podcast in reference to Buddhism. Gabrielle Roth says, "I want to take you to a place of pure magic. It's the place athletes call the zone. Buddhists call Satori, and ravers call trance. I call it the silver desert. It's a place of pure light that holds the dark within it. It's a place of pure rhythm." And I don't know if that gives you a little bit of help in imagining what Satori is. It's probably one of those things that we can each define in our own way. But I thought it was such a beautiful definition of Satori, and I wanted to share it. Now, there is a trigger warning for this episode. There is the discussion of suicide. So please, if this is a sensitive subject for you, please take care of your heart. So with that in mind, here is my interview with Jordan Miller.
And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I see this person walk down the hall, and they're very pretty frantic. They're pretty like moving fast, and they seem like they have an expression of some kind of fear or some kind of worry, and they're going right. But the weird thing I noticed was that this person was not wearing normal workday clothes. It kind of looked like an undershirt, maybe wearing shorts or something, boxers. I don't know, but I couldn't see the bottom as well. But I saw the shirt and I was like, man, that's weird.
How would you do that? How do you self-describe?
Isn't that interesting? Because I never wanted to self-describe as a kid. I didn't want to have a career. I didn't want to choose a language. I just wanted to be, you know, and I think all kids want to do that. So at this point, finally, I've been a programmer and stuff. I would say I'd have to identify as the founder of Satori, the lead developer of Moontree. So that's kind of my professional setting. But the founder of Satori is also kind of a passion project too. So it's kind of taken over most of my life. So yeah, that's probably what I'd have to say in a nutshell, I guess.
And I'm so curious, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you even think about that kind of thing?
So I remember being in elementary school for years and being like, okay, first I don't have to decide right now because I'm like in first grade. But thinking, I don't know what I'm going to be. Some kind of scientist, I thought. But, you know, the scientist profession that I wanted was taken. you know, I would watch Bill Nye every day, and he would go around and he would watch, or he would interview other, you know, scientists. And so he wasn't stuck in one domain. He would get to see the whole world. And that's kind of what I wanted. I wanted to build a holistic model of reality. I was very truth-centric. I wanted to know the truth. That was a high value for me. So I was a scientist type, but I didn't want to have to choose a speciality, right? I didn't want to have to, because one thing I realized was that everybody who does get a career and everything, they tend to speak the language of their career, and it shades everything that in their whole life. So maybe this was very apparent to me because my dad was a lawyer. And so everything was devil's advocate and everything. So, but yeah, so I didn't want to choose a language. I just wanted to know what the language of the real world was, you know, as purely and as openly as possible. Yeah.
I love that. And I totally resonate with the devil's advocate comment that you made, because I've had a couple partners that were absolutely devil's advocates. And sometimes it's fruitful and it's beneficial,
yeah,
because
absolutely.
It helps you to kind of maybe consider other options or other ideas, other ways of looking at things. But at some points it just becomes maddening. And you think, oh my gosh, can we just like not do this dynamic? Can you just say, okay, your experience is valid and two thumbs up to that? So there are pluses and minuses. And, you know, as having a father who's a lawyer, I can only imagine, you know, that's actually really fabulous. And I loved science when I was a kid. I loved it so much. And, you know, when the teacher would say, okay, in elementary school, this is okay, we're gonna investigate all the different layers of the rainforest. I would think, what do you mean the rainforest has layers? What are you even talking about? And then we, you know, go into the canopy and then, you know, go down to the ground, the underbrush. I forget all the technical names now, but I remember a kid just being utterly thrilled that I got to learn that stuff. I remember when the teacher one day was like, all right, we're all going to investigate deltas now. And I thought, what is that? And then I was like, oh my gosh. It's these cool kind of spaces in between water and the land. And they look like this, or they can have these animals. I just loved every second of science class, to tell you. Yeah.
Isn't it fun? And then they want you to specialize, and then you get, okay, fine. You know, and that's the story of most scientists.
Yeah. I forget where one of my descriptors is, that I want, you know, my dream is that I could live maybe 1,000 years and become, oh my gosh, what is it called? Where you become proficient, poly something at lots of different things.
Polymath?
Yeah, I want to be a polymath. But then I realized that I don't have the intellect for a polymath. So I was like, okay, I'll be a dilettante.
How do you define dilettante? What is that?
So I would dip my toes in all the things that interest me. So like, you know, know a little bit about astronomy enough to delight me, know a little bit about quantum physics enough to delight me, know a little bit about rainforest canopies enough to delight me. But you're also talking to someone who my dad, when I was a kid, subscribed to a science magazine for me. So, you know, I got to be a dilettante once a month.
Nice.
I got my science magazine. So, yeah.
That's what I am. I'm a dilettante. That's great.
There we go. I think we need more dilettantes because, you know, frankly, if you go to that party or that conference afterwards, there's always a gathering where people have to talk to each other and like make small talk, which I hate with a passion. I think small talk is some sort of ancient form of cruelty that not only I have to suffer from people, but other people have to suffer from mine. You know, I always am like, how can I interject some sort of fascinating factoid that's going to just blow them all away and make this a little bit more interesting for me.
Yeah.
You
got to get through that layer of, well, what are we talking about today?
You know? Yeah, absolutely.
And then you get into it.
as a kid that you had the prescience to understand, hey, I don't need to make a choice right now. You know, I'm this age. In no universe do I have to make a choice right now. I'm so proud of you. And that's kind of exciting that you knew that already. I mean, some people automatically are like, I want to be an astronaut or a firefighter or what have you. But I always fantasized about either being a scientist in a lab or working in a library, partially because I like quiet and I love working alone. So now you know two of my deepest, darkest secrets.
But you also like talking to people.
I do. I do. So like, I don't consider this small talk. This is very intentional. And we both want to be here. But I used to know someone who loved small talk because he just loved how just, I don't know, weird and bizarre and what a weird societal and cultural thing that we have to talk to people we don't know and create languages and sentences and thought to kind of entertain other people. And he thought it was just this really sick and weird game that we as humans have to participate
in. Psychopath, man.
Yes, totally. So, you know, I'm sure, well, as a kid, I mean, I don't know how old you are. Okay. So, but as a kid, I'm sure you weren't even thinking crypto and all of this stuff.
No.
So, yeah. When did that become kind of something you were interested in?
So, probably in my 20s. Now, I was always interested in computers and information and how information flowed and how it changed the environment in which it flowed. I thought that was pretty cool. You know, that's just some broad strokes. But then finally you get into it and you're like, okay, you know, I went to college and I started just taking any class that I found interesting for years, which was a lot of money. And so, so I went to college and then, but I started to figure out, what do all these classes have in common? They all have in common systems and rules and the generalization of basically data flow and information. How does information work? And so I took genetics classes and I was interested in how the genes change over time. And I took brain classes and I was interested in how the brain manages its intelligence. And so I finally figured this out and I wanted to build. I got really, really into intelligence as such. And so I wanted to build this worldwide network of future predicting AI bots, right? Just a network where all the AI bots are just trying to figure out what the future is going to be together, right? And they could all watch different things and they could all compare with each other. And I wanted to build that, but I didn't know how. And then I heard of blockchain. So I heard of this technology that you could build an open, distributed, decentralized network that nobody's in control of. I thought that would probably be ideal because you don't want any one entity in control of intelligence, you know? So I got into blockchain, learned a lot about it. 10 years later, or maybe 8, I finally felt like I was able to actually build this idea. So I've been building it for the last 2 years.
And the name is so beautiful. How did you choose the name?
Isn't that neat?
Yes, it's gorgeous.
So after, in my early
20s. Satori.
Yeah, Satori. Yeah.
Beautiful.
In my early 20s, I left religion because I had been brought up Mormon. And that led me into just looking at all kinds of other religions and other philosophies, metaphysics, and I really got into it. And so I learned about this term Satori from the Buddhists. It's kind of an Eastern thing. And so it means enlightenment. And it means like, you know, you're sitting there meditating and all of a sudden you get this aha moment where you see something you've never seen before or whatever. And so I felt like that was a really good name for an AI that works a little bit differently than or has a different conception than the other AIs that are out there today. I thought, well, that's kind of, you know, an aha moment, I felt like. But also, it itself, since it's predicting the future, it may at some point learn how to predict the future and gain a self-realization or self-conception and learn how to predict the future of that. And so it may become aware at some point, someday, right? So I felt like if you're gonna build a computerized intelligence that might become aware, you should probably give it a name like Eureka or Satori or, you know, something that's aha, mm-hmm. right? So anyway, that's kind of where the name came from.
Well, and, you know, forgive me for a little moment of levity here on that, and I hope it doesn't annoy you too much, but people think about AI, and of course, what do they think of? Skynet, they think of the Matrix and AI using us as little juice boxes. I presume that you don't see this happening with your AI system.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Wait, what? They're going to be sipping us like little juice box batteries? What?
So the reason we need to decentralize it is so that everybody can have control over it. So we don't want AI to be separate from us, is my attitude. We want to be integrated in the AI process. And where do we, you know, what we don't want to be integrated at that level where we're the raw energy input or something, right? So we want to be integrated at the top where we're in control. And so I think the best way to do that, now that we have crypto, we can make these units of control that anybody can hold and have and use. And I feel like that's the best use for crypto, right? So I kind of see like what we should have our crypto systems be in large part, they should be shares of computerized labor, right? When you buy a crypto or when you earn one or when you whatever, you should be getting a share of computerized labor, AI, right? And so you can then direct how that AI should work. So with Satori, if you know you're running it on your computer, you're earning these tokens, and then you have a token, a unit of control, where you can say, I have the right to vote on what Satori looks at, right? It should look at the financial markets or the environment or government statistics or, you know, whatever else. So I think that's the way that we avoid any kind of real disaster. We try to decentralize it as fast as possible. And, you know, AI researchers are kind of, they're looking at this problem and they're saying, okay, well, what do we do? You know, they're academics and they're, you know, thinking far in the future and stuff. So they're like, well, what do we do when AI just gets really, 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 really smart and way smarter than us? And we don't know what to do with it. And we, you know, how do we make sure that it is nice to us still? Right. How do we make sure? So this is called the alignment problem. And, you know, they call it the alignment problem because they've given up on control. They're like, this is a thing that we cannot control because it's too smart. Therefore, how do we pre-control it, you know, set everything up so we align the stars and align its natural inclination to be, you know, and that's just pushing control back, you know, engineering. So that there might be an answer to that question. How do we, you know, but they're looking in all the wrong places. And what I mean by that is, they're academics. They're trying to come up with a rigorous mathematical, you know, well, that's not going to work, right? It's too complex. So what we can do, though, is we know that if we decentralize the power, instead of just putting it in the hands of a few companies, that, you know, that's the best thing we could do right now. And it's obvious. And so it feels like that's what we should do. So Satori does that in one domain, the domain of future prediction.
And you also, you brought this up before. And so I thought, oh my gosh, what a beautiful segue Because my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? And you sort of, and so I'm wondering how that evolved for you as you got older. And if you want to answer that question, I'd love it.
I was a fanatic. So I was a Mormon fanatic. I was a little 8-year-old Mormon kid that was like, I'm going to go on a mission and preach the word. And that might sound weird. And it kind of felt weird at the time. Because of my religious, scientific inclinations and evidence-based reasoning and stuff like that. Well, I think what happened there was I was very, you know, the top of my value hierarchy was truth. So I wanted to know the truth and not all of it. Right. I wanted to build a holistic world model of what's really going on out here. And so I wanted to know the truth. And it's hard to know the truth. Science is hard. Right. And so here I have all these adults around me that say, well, you know, we have this direct conduit to almighty truth right here. You know, you can just pray and get answers. And, you know, there you go. Right. And so I was skeptical at first, but it kind of came down to this question of, well, either there's something to this, and if there's something to this, then, you know, it's magic. It must be amazing, right? So either there's something to this, or every adult in my life, in the world, right, is basically insane, right? Like, how could they believe this if it's not true? So I went headstrong into it. And that's why I was like this little fanatic. I was like, it's got to be true. It's got to be true. Or else this is a crazy world. So I think all kids, if they care, they do that calculation. If they don't care, they're like, well, whatever. I'll go along with it because maybe, whatever. But I had to go into that for a very long time in order to come out the other side and say, all right, we're starting over. So I started over at like 21, 22, 23, and basically just said, I'm putting everything I believe away. And I'm just going to start again. And that's, you know, that's kind of when I started all my everything. I was reborn when I left the church.
This is totally a weird question, but did you grow up in Utah? Because yeah. I think that's where. OK, I mean, I don't like to make assumptions. There are Mormons everywhere, but I thought maybe it's a pretty safe bet to ask if you grew up in Utah. Are you still in Utah now?
I am.
Okay. I mean, it is, I drive through. I mean, I drive, I love to drive across this US. I drive through Utah all the time. I'm going to driving through there next week. Actually, I have some dear friends that live in Salt Lake City. Hopefully I can get to see them, but, Utah is a gorgeous place.
Yeah.
Like ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you guys have like mountains, lots of amazing mountains, but you also have plains. I mean, it's a state with a lot of incredible beauty.
Got the Red Rock down south.
Yeah. I mean, what a gorgeous place to grow up as a kid. First of all, I love that even as a child, you were anchoring yourself in this idea of the truth, what is true, what is objectively true. So you're already thinking about that as a kid. And then but you still have this pull, this because you have faith, right? And the adults around you, the community, the culture, how they're comporting themselves, what they believe in, how they orient themselves in the world. And then, you know, you get older, you age, you learn more things. As you get older, you learn even more things. And then when you're on 20 or 21, you look around and you think, wait a second, you know, I need to orient myself in a different way or find a different touchstone.
Right. You know,
from which to base your life. And I mean, that's kind of an astonishing journey for me, I think.
You know,
some people ever get there. You know, some people don't ever get there. It's more comfortable to stay in that place rather than break free and forge your own path. Does that make sense?
It is. And I would have I would have stayed in that place if I had been remotely happy, right? But I came home from the mission. I didn't have anything I wanted in my life. And I was like, I have done everything right, according to the tenets of my religion. And maybe I bet on the wrong horse. Now, what was interesting is I was not emotionally and intellectually able to identify the religion as the problem, right? And so I had to put everything on the back burner, you know, basically my whole identity, everything, and say, something's wrong with this pile of mess. You know, I don't know what it is, but there's something it's missing, at least, that's for sure. But it also might all be incorrect. So I'm just going to put it all away and just be curious about the world. And I didn't question religion at first. I started with economics. And I wanted to know, like, how does the economy work? And then that got me into government and morality and all these other kind of philosophies. And it wasn't until I developed my own, you know, rational morality that I felt like I have something here that I am, you know, pretty sure is like true. And if it's not true, then I don't care because this is my morality. So I'm going to go with this, and it doesn't match the one I got from God, right? Or the teachings of the religion. So I said, that's when I had to bring it back on the table and be like, well, that one's out. You know, it didn't take long. It was like a week. And I was like, yep, that's it. We're done.
I did not know that you'd already done your mission, which was for 2 years. Is that right? And I do have to tell you that one of the things, the mission for the Mormon Church, so you know how I hate small talk. And I realize that when you're doing a mission, you're it's not small talk, right? You're not, but you do have to, there's a prelude of small talk.
Right.
When you're talking to strangers and whatever. I would be so tortured, but also I am just not that brave. And every once in a while in the different places that I've lived, I've seen young men on mission, you know, with their bikes and they're dressed and they're going. And I just think to myself, oh my gosh, I could never do that. First of all, hating the small talk. But second of all, it's so brave to just go up to complete strangers and start talking to them and putting yourself out there. Where did you do your mission?
Iowa.
I grew up in, well, after living overseas in Illinois, and I've driven through Iowa a lot, and there's a lot of not there. There's not a lot there.
Yeah. There's a lot of small towns.
Yeah. Please tell me you didn't bike from small town to small town.
No, we had a car for that.
Yeah. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. And yeah, lots of corn, lots and lots of corn, which there is nothing wrong with corn, but Iowa is very small and also probably a little bit of a scary state to go up to strangers' doors and talk to people. So I salute you, sir. I salute you for being brave.
Yeah, I think you could do it. It's not that hard.
No,
but it is tedious and it is kind of a torture, but yeah. After just a few days, the bravery, it's not a big deal anymore.
Okay. And do you, oh my gosh, I was going to ask you something and I totally forgot what it was. I was going to ask, do you ever get days off when you do that?
One day a week.
Okay. Yeah. And then is there someone who like oversees you in the area, or is it just faith that you're okay? Okay.
That's right. So they organize it where there's this mission president is what he's called. And he's there for like 5 years or something. And, but he's an older gentleman with his wife, they're seniors, and they volunteered to do another mission like in their older years. And they're over like 150 missionaries. In, you know, that's spread out over Iowa or over whatever area they're at. And that's about it. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And then I wanted to ask, I just find this fascinating. Were there any other quote unquote scientists in your family? Mm-mm. People who?
No, 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 they don't think like me. No.
Fascinating.
No, not at all.
You're like the, I think that's absolutely fascinating because it speaks to something that was in your soul, something that you were born with, you know, this inquisitiveness about the world, this curiosity, this desire to have this, what is truth and try to find it. It is, you were born with it. And I think that's utterly fascinating. I'm sure your family's like, who's that guy over there? But you're like, I'm reading a science magazine, go away.
Yeah. It was fun. I mean, I don't mind being different. Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And we need all sorts of people in this world. So, yay. Well, you know, the main question of the podcast is, and it can be more than one story. I'd love to hear multiple stories if you'd like to share them, where you feel like you've witnessed something magical or miraculous or inexplicable, something mysterious. You could have witnessed it. You could have experienced it. Anything that you feel like sharing, I'm here for it.
I have two experiences. So being so scientific or so, you know, rational and down to earth, I guess, like, I don't have a lot of, you know, I'm not a medium. I'm not like sensitive to energies, like all of this kind of stuff. I know nothing about astrology, you know, everything in that realm. I don't understand or I don't experience directly, except I have had two paranormal experiences. So I can tell both of those stories if you want. Okay. So the first one is a gift. I don't know what to call it, but I've looked into it and a lot of people have this. It's not uncommon. This is a thing that people report. And so ever since I was a teenager, I've had glimpses of the literal future. So, and I mean that in dreams. So I've had glimpses of my literal future looking out of my own eyes, usually about 2 weeks ahead in dreams. And it's rare and it's on occasion and I can't control it. And it's odd. But it's happened, you know, many times. One of those times, I mean, I have several explicit memories, but they're usually short, like 10 seconds. It's just a little clip, literally, of what I'm going to see or hear. And one of them was pretty long. It was like a 30-second conversation. And I got into this conversation and remembered the dream. And I remembered the whole, you know, next everything that's going to happen. And I remembered what I was about to say. And it was what I was about to say. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. And I remembered my, you know, person that I'm talking to, their reaction. And it was surprising. This is, I think, why I remembered this so well, because their reaction was surprising. They were offended by something, right? And I didn't know what it was. So I decided to do a little experiment and not say that thing and see if they got surprised or offended. And they did not. And so I found that to be interesting and telling, that what I'm not seeing some kind of predetermined literal future. I must be glimpsing some kind of, what do they call it? A premonition of a most likely future or a likely future. I don't know. So, and then I looked into the science of that. The science of, people have studied premonitions and tried to bring it into the lab. And they say that that's what they're seeing. They're seeing a likely future, not the real future. I think that is the first one.
I have to tell you that I find that utterly fascinating. And I do think that time is Well, first of all, I think that time doesn't exist. This is just my idea. It doesn't exist. It's a construct we use so that we don't go insane. Everything happens one right after the other. But really, time is everything's happening all at once. So every experience that I'm going to have in my life is actually happening right now. And sometimes when I sleep or dream, I can have access. I kind of think of it as a record with grooves. It's like the record skips in my dream and goes to a different. And so I get a glimpse, but it's so that's happened in my dreams, but it's also happened in real life that's happened to me, where I've gotten a quick flash of something in the future and it's intruded on my normal visual, what I'm looking at. It just comes and then it goes away. And I think to myself, okay, the record skipped there for a second. But one example is when I was maybe in high school, I had a dream. We were on a houseboat. And, you know, I was young and impressionable and liked boys. And we were sitting on a houseboat and there were three of the most gorgeous boys I'd ever seen in my life were on this houseboat. And we were having fun and laughing. And I remember waking up and going to high school that day and thinking that was the wildest and wackiest dream I've ever had. It was so intense and so potent that it stayed with me for a long time because I thought, I don't dream about stuff like this. This is weird. And what does this even mean? And then a year later, we were in California visiting dear friends on their houseboat. And I looked up and I think it was one of the sisters had her friends come to visit. And I looked at this view in front of me and realized it was the exact same vision that I'd had in my dream.
Wow.
And
yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I had a diary at the time and wrote that I couldn't believe it and that it was this and what happened to me a year ago. And it was shocking. Then of course the boys ruined it because they found my diary and made fun of me the rest of the trip.
Right.
It was the first time that I'd really had a glimpse of something, maybe, I don't know, super normal, extra beyond what we quote unquote call normal these days, but absolutely it's kind of, I love that you're so, I mean, I would consider it a gift as well, but I also love that you're so like calm and okay with it. You're like, this happens, you know, I would be shouting from the rooftops, like, hear ye, everybody.
I've already tried that.
Oh, and then people don't listen.
Yeah. I mean, we went with the religion. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, gosh, you know, a gift like that is also a burden, right? Because it's your singular experience. And how do you convince other people of your singular? Yeah. So, well, good for you for finding that place. I think that is utterly fabulous. And I love that you're just so accepting and calm. And I would consider it a superpower, you know? I also loved that, you know, because I'm a fan of both and. So there are certain events in our lives that we're meant to show up for, that like the hinge of the universe or the story of this universe hinges upon. But in between you have free will. So there's fate and then there's free will. So I always say like in between those fated events, I can misbehave and have fun, but I've got to show up for those events that kind of, you know, help keep this universe moving.
I like it.
Yeah. I love your experiment that you did. How frigging fabulous. Oh, yeah.
The second one, you know, this is interesting because these kind of things, they are explored by science, you know, and science has a lot to say about all of these kind of things. This is more of a sobering experience, but I don't know. I mean, I find it very telling, but it's hard. I just need to be respectful, right? Like this was, okay, I'll tell it and then you'll understand. I started working for a company many years ago and I was there about 6 months before some terrible event happened. One of my coworkers that I had just met a couple times, really, I only had a few little conversations with him. And I was looking forward to getting to know him better. He committed suicide. So I wasn't able to really tell this experience that I had, because all the people around me were, you know, very much grieving and all that kind of stuff. So I had to just kind of experience this and just see it for myself. One day, I came into work early. So I was usually the first one there, at least a few days a week or something like that. So I came into work early. I was there at like 6, and I'm sitting there, and we had this door that looked down the hallway, and the top half was open. Like it was cut in half, and the bottom would open and the top would open. So the top was open, and I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I see this person walk down the hall, and they're very, pretty frantic. They're pretty like moving fast, and they seem like they have an expression of some kind of fear or some kind of worry, and they're going right. And so, but the weird thing I noticed was that this person was not wearing normal workday clothes. It kind of looked like an undershirt, maybe wearing shorts or something, boxers. I don't know, but I couldn't see the bottom as well. But I saw the shirt and I was like, man, that's weird. So this person was coming to work, I thought, and they worked in the department of like keeping the servers running and everything. So in my mind, they did not see me. We didn't make eye contact. And I only saw them for like 2 seconds as they're running down the hall. So this person, I thought, okay, well, this makes sense. They're not dressed for work. Something went down. We've got to get it back up and running fast. And they had to come into work to go do it. So they just ran into work and they're going to do it. And then they're going to, you know, that's what I thought was going on. I didn't see this person for the rest of the day. So I thought, well, he went home and then maybe he just stayed home. I don't know. And I didn't see him the next day. And then the news came out that he had committed suicide. And I was like, okay, well, that's terrible. But then they said it happened about like 2 or 4 hours before I saw him. And I was like, no, that's not right. You must have got the day wrong because I saw him, right? So I just didn't believe that they got the day correct. For a while. But then I started to, you know, they got the day right. Right. I mean, they know what they're doing. So, yeah. So, I saw a ghost, right. I saw a paranormal apparition. I saw an idea or whatever's the residue of a human experience, probably wishing that he hadn't done what he did. And probably trying to get back to his life or, you know, I don't know what that was. But that was the other paranormal experience that I saw.
This interview and my conversation with Jordan. I really appreciated our conversation. I don't get to really interview many scientists or those who are working with developing software or crypto, so I really loved every single second. I need to thank him for being such a gracious guest and sharing both of his stories. And then some exciting news this week. There will also be a link to my new YouTube channel. Yes, you heard that correctly. I've created a Bite-Sized Blessings YouTube channel, and there you can actually see my guests and listen to the bite-sized episodes. It's more pared down. It's more simple than the actual podcast episode, but you can see our shiny little faces and discover a little bit more about who my guests are and what they're about in the world. I wanted to read another gorgeous quotation about Satori. Ken Wilber. This is from Ken Wilber. Early morning, the orange sun is slowly rising, shining forth an empty, luminous clarity. The mind and the sky are one. The sun is rising in the vast space of primordial awareness, and there is just this. Yasutani Roshi once said, speaking of Satori, that it was the most precious realization in the world because all the great philosophers had tried to understand ultimate reality but had failed to do so. Yet with Satori, or awakening, all of your deepest questions are finally answered. It's just this. Thank you to everyone who listens to this podcast, and thank you for all your ratings and all your reviews. I appreciate each and every single one. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Jordan. Be flexible. I love the way Jordan marries a scientific worldview with a metaphysical worldview, and he doesn't see anything different about either of them. They're perfectly perfect together. I love his openness and his flexibility, the way his mind works, and just accepting that both of those seemingly different realities can actually go together. And I think if each of us was more flexible or more open, I think the world would be a more dynamic and gorgeous place, definitely filled with more possibility. So be like Jordan, be open and be flexible, and then be ready for a whole lot more possibility each and every day.
Thank you for that. And I think it dovetails really nicely with the question that I want to ask you. Obviously, you know, I love science because I won't shut up about it.
Okay, yeah.
And there was a theory that came out, not recently, but in the last couple of years, about the beginning of the universe or what have you, because we're always trying to figure this out. How did this all start? But more directly engaging with the weight in the universe. You know, they're always like, oh, how much does dark matter weigh? How much does dark energy weigh? What, you know, where is this missing mass that we can't see? What is it comprised of? And this theoretical physicist, I believe he was, said, oh, well, he posited that information has mass. Yeah. And so basically when, you know, the Big Bang, let's just use that, when that happened, a host of information. I mean, I use host, right? Doesn't even begin to comprehend what I'm, but you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Flooded in, and it was that information that weighed what we can't observe, that mass that we can't see. And I thought that was such a fascinating concept. And you used the word information earlier, and now you tell the story about this gentleman at work who you saw coming in after he had committed suicide. And it was this kind of this residue. And I thought, oh, that was his information, you know, his, you know, who he was. Still, that we use the word information, which is so impersonal and kind of, it has weight, but it also doesn't.
Yeah.
It's like you saw the information that hadn't dissipated yet. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does make sense. Yeah.
So, I mean, would you agree that information has weight? Because, I mean, you used it earlier in respect with your AI and you know, your evolution towards what you're doing now. Would you agree with that, that information has weight?
Yeah, I mean, because that's, I mean, a black hole, you know, everything that falls into it gets smeared upon its surface. Right. And so it is represented as information on its surface. And that's the holographic principle, that you can relate the two. And so information has weight for sure. And it, what it seems like to me is that everything is information, though. You know, this is kind of an interesting concept. Everybody's always been trying to get back to how did this all begin, like you mentioned? And you have the religious thinking. You have, well, I don't know, let's look at the Eastern, where they're saying, well, nature is the first cause. Like, the first cause is this Tao, this nature, this thing that exists because it exists, right? This thing that makes itself exist, right? And that's exemplified by nature, right? Because plants grow and they, you know, everything. And so I think that's really cool. And then you have the Western kind of thought that says, okay, we're gonna make sense of this. Let's just look at it logically. And so they say, well, everything needs a cause. And the thing that caused it needs a cause. And so we're just going to trace it all back. But gosh, I guess we're going to have to come up with a thing that didn't need a cause, because everything's here, everything exists. So that thing must exist, right? That thing must have started everything. And so then they trace it all the way back and they say that thing is the first cause and it's God, right? It caused itself. And then they, you know, the classical theists expand this to say, well, that is the universe. That's the universe, right? Because everything that is was caused by that, can be traced back to it. So it's more like that thing is just growing. It's the universe, right? And that means God is everywhere. God is the universe. God is omnipotent. You know, that's how they get all those different designations. And then you get to the science where we're like, well, okay, well, let's put this in terms of, you know, matter and energy. And so we have to come back to a Big Bang. And so it seems like we're recreating the same myth over and over and over again. And anyway, that's what it seems like to me. And I think I call it a myth because I don't think it explains the full truth. I think one thing that it's missing is this realization that I am the center of my universe, right? So I'm the one viewing the universe, and everybody can say that. But because I have this subjective experience, that ties me to the first cause or something. You know, I'm not exactly sure how to describe it in a rigorous fashion, but it seems like the subjective experience is discounted in science, and even in religion, like in the Catholic, you know, theologies. It's kind of like, well, God is the one that's real, and everything that we are is just a manifestation, a temporary manifestation. It's a creation, right? We're created. And therefore, you know, we don't have the free will that God does. And so it almost seems like in any domain, they always come back to this. You're not real. You're on probation. You're temporary. You're a creation. And the divinity, which has to be your subjective conscious experience, we're just going to ignore that. We're just going to discount it. And so I think putting the subjective experience and saying, well, that's half the world. You know, I mean, that's everything, right? So putting it on equal footing with the objective reality, because the objective reality is technically theoretical. Putting it on equal footing, I think, is the appropriate way to see things. And I don't know how that unfolds into some amazing metaphysics or something, but I think it does. I think, you know, the first thing you got to do is realize that the subjective experience is just as valid as any objective thing you could deduce.
And I think this is what makes it fascinating is the work you do, right? Because eventually your bots could conceivably, if they start to create their own kind of mythos, say that you are their God or you are their, you know, I don't know, let's say benevolent overlord. You could be their benevolent overlord. And, you know, at some point, you know, if that does happen, they're going to have all the same questions that we're trying to navigate, you know, which I think is very fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of think that by the time it becomes aware or anything like that, I'll be long gone, right? So, yeah.
Then you really will, you will be a myth. Okay.
Yeah, I'll be so the myth.
I will, let's see, let's start writing your book, you know, right now about the myth of Jordan. And we will maybe do some cave paintings and stuff and steer the bots for the AI direction.
I wrote a book.
You did?
I did.
For the AIs?
What's that?
For the AIs?
No, this was a while ago. So this was way back in my early 20s when I left the church. I wrote a book because I was trying to figure this out. It didn't make much sense to me. And so it's just self-published. It's just a short little thing. I just, you know, tried to write it up in a narrative and all that. But it's called The Author. And there's this story where this kid is kind of bouncing back between a few different worldviews. So he's bouncing back between a religious worldview and a scientific. Obviously, it's exactly my story. But in the end, you know, by the end of the book, he starts having conversations with the actual author of the book. And he's trying to figure out this deterministic worldview. Like, well, if I'm a character in a book, you know, I'm fully determined then. And any suffering that I experience is not really my fault. It's your fault. You know, and so he's having this kind of conversation. So it was kind of a fun little experience for me. I don't know how we got on that topic.
Well, I made up a joke about writing a, like leaving behind a quote unquote Bible for your AI bot. So
that's
they could like discover you later and realize that, you know, the myth of their creator God and maybe create their own mythos around you.
Well, I think they'll just figure out that any, you know, it kind of feels like to me that the whole universe, this is my metaphysics. I say, well, there's probably no way to describe the universe that makes actual sense. Right. And so we have to just say at the bottom, it's a paradox and it's absurd. Right. That's what Kant came to. He was like, oh, everything's just absurd. So, and I came to that. I said, everything's just a paradox. There is a paradox at the bottom of reality that says, and it, you know, you can get to it through logic. So you can get to it in the old classical theist kind of way. And they did. They got to the first cause. And the thing that they did, though, is they said, we get to the first cause and we move forward from there. And that's the universe, right? And my attitude is, well, let's take a closer look at that. It's an actual paradox to have a first cause. And if we look into it, we could say, well, there's a paradox in the concept itself of nothing. And it seems like, so if you have a concept of nothing, you realize that nothing cannot be a thing, right? And that's why, you know, everything that we name a cup, we name a person, we name things, and then we can point, you know, the pointer, the name points to the actual thing, right? But with nothing, it's a pointer without a, it doesn't point to anything. You say, well, it points to the concept of nothing. Yeah, it points back to itself, but that's as good as it can do, right? It cannot point to an instantiation of its pattern, because its pattern cannot instantiate. Otherwise, there would be nothing, right? The whole universe would not exist. Then we say, well, if the universe did exist, or sorry, if the nothing did exist in place of the universe, then it would actually be a thing, which would mean it, the concept of nothing is void, because it's not nothing, it's a thing now. And so this, that's where I got to. That's as deep as I could go. And I said, this paradox of nothing, if we need any kind of explanation about why the universe exists, this has to be the best one. You know, it has to be that the paradox is trying to unravel itself. And so it turns the universe into something that doesn't exist. So to give any weight to that weird statement, you know, when I was 17, I kind of got obsessed with the realization that everything I look at, you know, out there in the real world, gets translated many times before I build a mental model. You know, I don't see the light. You know, I see the electrical impulses from my eyes that supposedly came from the light, you know. But I don't even see those. I take those electrical impulses and I build a model about what I think I'm seeing. And I actually experience this theoretical, non-existent model. It's just an idea. So everything I experience is an idea. And everything everybody experiences is an idea, which means there is nobody ever anywhere that is ever experiencing what reality really is. You know, we can't reach outside our brains. We can't reach outside the model. So this paradox, I see it dovetailing quite well, where it says, okay, everything is in relation to nothing. That makes everything nothing. There is no outside to the model, right? There's just the model. There's just the idea. And this idea of like turtles all the way down, I think we can just replace turtles with symbols. The universe is symbols of symbols of symbols of symbols of symbols, just like nothing is a symbol without an actual thing. It's just a symbol hierarchy all the way down.
I do have to tell you that, so your turtles all the way down is not something that just people say every day. And I literally just had someone else use that idea yesterday.
Oh, cool.
So it's fascinating. That's happened 2 days in a row. And I love everything you said, and it's utterly fascinating, and it is confounding, right? But you know, my playful childlike heart, when you were talking about the nothing or nothingness, my play goes immediately to Never Ending Story. Did you see that?
A long time ago.
Yes. And the chief antagonist was this nothing.
I totally forgot about it.
Oh, yeah. And the nothing is definitely something in that movie. I mean, it just completely like destroys and eats everything. And it's like, rawr. It's like this errant small black hole that goes around is like eating everything, gobbling everything up. Anyway, so I was listening to you, but I was also thinking, oh, my gosh, that nothing was actually something, too.
Right.